It's the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. We will have Fionnuala and Michael in studio with us very shortly indeed to discuss entertainment. Just before we do that, let's take some of your comments. Caller says, my son got approved for a Susie grant, but you can't get it in Northern Ireland. It's ridiculous now. We do have to pay fees. With regards to the President Biden visit, I think it's wrong how critical people are of President Biden's visit to Ireland. He comes from immigrants who left during the famine and have traditional Irish Celtic values that have been lost here in Ireland. The President will also bring a lot of American tourism, which will give us great wealth. It's really unfair how people are treating a man of his age in this way. Another caller says, I was disgusted to hear Leo Varadkar's speech during the US President banquet dinner for Joe Biden at Dublin Castle, talking about dignity and helping others to find their own paths to freedom. With the ongoing homelessness, young people leaving the country and other issues happening here, I find it disgusting that we have leaders like that in power when they don't even care or have a clue about what's happening in their own country. Another caller says, as a committed Christian, I'm baffled and puzzled to figure out how can any president of any country, including our own, talk about the dignity and integrity of any human being when one has reversed Roe versus Wade and one has repealed the Eighth. Two words used repeatedly by both presidents yesterday. I'm totally confused, considering the Constitution of the USA is in God we trust. I don't think God approves of aborting innocent babies from the mother's womb. Now, in God we trust, I know it's on the dollar bill. I'm not sure those words are in the Constitution. It's certainly on the money. Mind you, there's an argument that says that the money is the Constitution in the US when all is said and done. But that's another argument entirely, and we ain't going to go there right now. Someone asked the question why the Queen got a great welcome in the South, but President Biden didn't get it from the Unionist community in the North. Perhaps the answers lie in the fact that Northern Ireland holds more moral values than those in the South. A man who claims to be a great Catholic attending Mass yet agrees with abortion is not a real man of values, so says a caller. Now it's Friday, and we all know what that means. Let's play the big one. And you're welcome to the entertainment slot on Highland Radio. You can hear that lovely hubbub and bustle of chairs being moved and all that. It means that we are joined in studio by our two entertainment gurus, Fionnuala Rabbitt and Michael. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning, Donal.
Guru.
I like the guru.
So much smarter.
I like that. I like that. Feel it's appropriate. Of course, gurus.
Well, there are people out there who are now effectively basing their entertainment consumption on what they're hearing. God help them.
But God help them, sad to hear, but there you go.
Now, we're going to talk about entertainment and we're going to talk about what's happening in cinema. And the first thing I want to talk about, though, is a film that I saw, because it's a film that went completely under the radar as far as I could see. And I went to it last week and it was fascinating. Hallelujah. The film that starred Jennifer Saunders.
Oh, I told you I wanted to see it.
Oh, yes, you did mention this. Did I? I don't remember saying that. I remember talking about her TV shows and stuff like that. Is it still in the cinema?
It was in Cinema 8 in Century last week.
And yeah, it's actually been out for a little while.
Yes, you had mentioned that.
And I've been meaning to go and see it and I never kind of got around to it, because I love those type of movies because they're just those quintessential British movies.
Yeah.
And I had been meaning to go and see it and I obviously love Jennifer Saunders. Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did. It was
very, very interesting. Now, there was a twist that I wasn't expecting and I'm not going to talk about in any way, shape or form.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was written by Mike Lee and you know when Mike Lee writes, it's going to be a film that's going to be full of social commentary. And one of the things that someone described it to was a love letter to the NHS. Now, there is one point where effectively it's about a doctor who is in Indian by birth and is in the UK and he's working in a hospital for older people. It's basically a respite home and it's St. Elizabeth's Respite Hospital for the elderly, generally known as the Bet. And everyone calls it the Bet and everyone knows it in the town, but it's facing potential closure because the figures don't add up at government level. And at that point, yeah, there is a hole and you know what's coming with Mike Lee. You're going to have a hole. This is really important, the NHS. And the film is narrated by this doctor. and it goes through day-to-day life and you get to know some of the patients. And there is a lot of really, I mean, everyone from David Bradley to Judi Dench. You know,
that's very, it sounds very good. Yeah.
There are some stellar acting performances in this. And you go, I know her, I know him, I know her,
yeah,
I know
yeah.
him. Oh yeah, that's the one who was in. And it was a really, really interesting film. And it was not talked about. I went to the cinema. It's funny. It's like buses. You don't go for ages, then you go two nights in a row. Yeah. And first night we went to John Wick 4. Because I had to go to John Wick.
Yeah, you have to go and see
I had
that.
To go to see John Wick.
Of course, yeah.
I love John Wick.
Yeah, they're great. Brilliant. They're fabulous. I haven't seen that one yet, but they're brilliant.
They're effectively, have you seen the first three?
Yes.
Yeah, you've pretty much seen the fourth. They're well. there are going to be no grounds broken here.
Yes.
It isn't suddenly going to become a
different
philosophical
type of
treatise on the meaning of life.
No, no.
Yeah. If you like John Wick, you'll like four.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it. Yeah. Now, it's a long one, isn't it? It's very long.
2.5. That's what my son said. I mean, as my son said, if you took out the fight scenes, it'd be about 35 minutes. But no, we all went and we all had an absolute ball. And then we went to Hallelujah the following night because I was interested in it and wanted to see it.
It sounds very good.
It is. And it's very interesting. And it's the sort of film it's a bit like Banshees of Inisherin in that you come out of it going, oh, what do you think of that? And you start having conversations and chatting. Oh, it's different, obviously, to Banshees. But it's got a thought piece, as I said, it does have a twist. The nature of which I will not in any way go into.
Were there many people there that night? You were down in screen 8, which
we were
is
in screen
smaller,
8.
Yeah.
I mean, screen 8 fits about, what, 30 people?
Yeah, it's a smaller screen. Yeah.
Is it even 30 people?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say it was pretty well full.
Yeah.
But then again, 20 people will fill it.
But it's a niche. So. It's obviously seen as a niche film as regards who will go to see it. It's not a massive, but just a bit.
It's amazing, though, because I have to say I didn't realise there was that much depth, and I don't mean to slam the movie that I haven't seen, depth to it. I was thinking it was going to be more like, you know, the literary potato Guernsey, the potato and literary set. You know, that it was going to be very...
No, actually. It has moments.
Those kind of... You know, those kind
it
of British...
It does have shoes, moments
like that.
Like the
Bank of Dave. There's a few of them that are out that are just... What I always think of the quintessential.
Yeah.
They're nearly like what the old black and white British war movies used to be, but now they're done in this particular way.
Yeah,
I didn't realise there was that much kind of a...
Oh, no, there is. Yeah, and I have to say...
twists and turns and depth to it.
Yeah, I have to say, I'll be looking out for a BAFTA for Jennifer Saunders as well, because she is absolutely superb in it.
Great.
And we all know Jennifer from Absolutely Fabulous and her work with Dawn French, etc.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very good, serious acting role. And what she's basically doing is showing that she is one hell of an actor.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, she's got great comic timing, etc., etc., but she is one hell of an actor in terms of her presence on the screen.
I wonder who's behind it. I mean, is it a Channel 4? Is it a BBC?
BBC
film.
Yeah,
okay.
it did come up with the BBC logo at the start, so it's BBC, and I say Mike Lee wrote it, so you know to an extent what you're getting with Mike Lee. There's a lot of social commentary and a lot of emphasis on the NHS, but and it is, you can see it's very much pro-NHS and what's this nasty government doing
to our
health service.
Yeah.
And this is the bedrock upon which our society is built. Mm-hmm. And that absolutely comes across. There is one point where it's pretty much a party political broadcast on behalf of the NHS. You know, which is perhaps no harm. It's an important thing to highlight in the UK in particular.
Point of view. Yeah, exactly.
But no, I just wanted to put it out there because
I've not heard anyone
talk about it.
Yeah. No, our conversation, because
I saw a trailer for it months ago.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I must go and see that, assuming that it was going to be one of those kind of feel good, you know, as I say, I don't want to say they're terrible, but because I actually really enjoyed them. You know what you're getting, you sit down, you're like, oh, this is going to be lovely. And there's every British actor you've ever seen.
Totally.
I was like, I mean, like, we were talking as we were going in the door and Mike said to me, who's in it? And I'm like, I assume Bill Nye, because he's in everything.
Yeah. I'm not sure Bill Nye's on this one. I know, but that's what I mean.
Do you know the way you're just like, anytime there's a kind of a British movie. But then I didn't really hear anything about it after that. And it seems to have gone very much under the radar, as you say.
No, I would certainly recommend it. I'm not sure if it's...
I wonder how long until it shows up somewhere streaming as well. The point is, they go to streaming so fast.
Really
fast these days, yeah. I wonder where... But anyway, if it's, I'd be interested in if it's in the cinema this week.
Right.
We'll check it out.
Because I like a good, serious kind of dig your teeth in.
Absolutely. Speaking of cinema, and someone said to me actually they went to see Dungeons & Dragons and they really enjoyed it, to the extent that they were surprised at how much they enjoyed it. Michael, you've seen it?
I've seen it. We've both seen it, myself and Lula, and a huge thumbs up from both of us, definitely from me. I thought it was a wonderful family film, a very funny, very smart movie. It reminded me of that Christmas Day, I think 1990, when RTE showed The Princess Bride, and that was the first time I saw that movie. To me, it had those same sort of vibes. And then when I went looking at the reviews, I saw about one out of every two reviewers had made the same observation. So I hadn't come up with anything particularly clever. But yeah, it's that same kind of fighting fantasy kind of thing, but done with tongue-in-cheek and very funny. Chris Pine, Michelle Rodriguez, the very handsome guy from Bridgerton, is it? Mm-hmm. That show that, yeah.
Yeah, Bridgerton.
And it's a straightforward thing. It's like it's like Lord of the Rings done with a few gags. It's kind of a group of people on a quest. The people behind it, one of the guys, John Francis Daly, I think, from back in the 19... I'm looking up here in my notes here. Yeah, Freaks and Geeks was the show he did back in the 90s. He was one of the kids on that show. That was a great show. He lasted a season. And then he spent about eight seasons on Bones as a sort of psychiatrist working with the team. He's an actor, a writer, a director. He's been responsible for things like Horrible Bosses, those movies, which were very great fun. And he's got credits on Spider-Man Homecoming. So this movie, which he co-wrote and co-directed, falls very much into his wheelhouse of being good fun, plenty of laughs, but action, adventure, big threats, big danger. It opened big in America. I think it fell off in the second weekend, but I'm hoping there'll be a franchise out of this. I hope we get to see a continuing adventures of Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez and the others.
Well, it's going to be my next visit to the cinema. Anyway.
Oh, it's
going
love to be Dungeons it. I think you'll really love it. Yeah. And Hugh Grant just about stole the movie. I mean, he was hilarious.
Yeah, he's
Hugh Grant was hilarious.
I enjoyed it now, not as much as you.
No, maybe, yeah. But you did enjoy it.
I mean, Princess Bride is like way better than it.
Princess Bride is one of the greatest films of all time.
I know. It's way better.
Princess Bride.
Yeah, it's way better than it. And it's Lord of the Rings is way better than it.
Yes.
But it is, I have to say, now, it could have been called absolutely anything because I went in. As anybody who listens to the show knows, I have always wanted to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes, that's
and
true.
Michael, I have done.
And Michael won't let me. So I have. He's just being mean.
The reason and is, Fanula thinks we're all so cool.
You're just being mean.
Cool. As soon as she shows up and sees what we're really doing,
cool.
She'll stop thinking I'm cool.
Have you just used Dungeons and Dragons?
And the word cool. Yeah, that's completely the opposite.
So
if they actually turn out to be cool, that's when I'd be disappointed. But anyway, so I went with this thinking that, oh, I'm going to get some sort of an idea of Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes.
It could have been called absolutely anything. Yeah. Given it its due. But it is an enjoyable movie. I could totally see them getting two or three out of it.
Oh, I hope so.
Given the story that's in it. I mean, the basic storyline is that there's this band of kind of misfits that have all met together. It's set in a mystical land in which there's a lot of different mystical creatures, all this kind of thing.
Dragons.
Magic,
and they have to find something.
Dragons. And what happens is that they've banded together and they've become, through their circumstances, they've become thieves and they've stolen the wrong thing. And then they have to try and
essentially,
it all
it's
out.
Every fantasy book and film ever written and ever made.
Yes, it is.
There was a wonderful comment when The Wheel of Time came out last year, and I was eagerly awaiting that because I devoured those books over the years of Wheel of Time. And I remember one of the reviewers, I think it was the Irish Times, the reviewer said, "This is high fantasy." And in brackets, it just said, high fantasy, i.e. the creators were so high they didn't realise they were ripping off Lord of the Rings. That's how we defined it. And I thought, you know, that's the best definition of high fantasy I have ever heard. Fanula, you've also seen Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, I went to Super Mario Brothers with my nieces and nephews and that kind of thing. They were all very excited. Now, some of the older ones have played it.
Yeah.
And some of the younger ones have just seen cartoons and different things of it. So they were very excited about it. And I have to say, they thoroughly enjoyed it. I think for myself, it's very much based on the game.
Yeah.
So there's not much of a story to it, which you'd often find with these animated movies. I shouldn't call them cartoons anymore now. There's so much goes into them. With an animated movie, you often see how they're pitched kind of for adults as well as for kids. Mm. And, you know, there's certain jokes or there's certain things that come into it. This is not at all. This is very much pitched for kids. And I think it's actually for younger kids.
Yeah.
So that would be my thinking on it, that if you're going to it. I've said the two movies that we saw, the Dungeons and Dragons, that one thing about that I couldn't believe was how much that was family pitched.
Yes.
I assumed going by the trailer and things like that, that you'd want to be like 12 to 16 to watch it, you know, just based on sort of the talk that was about it going around. But actually, it's beautifully pitched for bringing the whole family.
It is,
if anybody is for the last kind of hurrah before the end of
and
the
week. And we were contrasting it with Shazam 2, which we'd seen the week before, which we both felt was quite dark and wouldn't really suit younger
Shazam
kids.
Shazam 1 was quite dark as well. I mean, yeah, there's the Shazam films are dark.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I know, but they're supposed to be for kids. But
and even
like
Zach Levi was saying in an interview about the poor box office, he was saying, oh, they mismarketed it, it's such a great family film. But I was like, no. And then we went to see Dungeons & Dragons and we were like, oh, any kids
that's
would love
a great
it.
Fan. Well, look, you're looking at Shazam and you're kind of like saying, I wouldn't bring any kids under, well, any kids that I know.
Yeah.
Obviously, all kids are different. But I wouldn't bring any kids that I know, my nieces and nephews, under the age of 8 to see Shazam.
Yeah.
You know, there's kind of a few jumpy, scary out bits. There's a few bits and pieces like that. There's the Dungeons and Dragons movie, you could bring your 5 and 6 year old and they'll find something that they'll love in it. The Super Mario is very much, any of the kids that are into any of the gaming and that kind of thing would just absolutely love it. It's all sort of based on that. The little adventures, Donkey Kong is in it. They're building carts. They're running around, rushing around, that kind of thing. What was missing for me was that usually there's an understanding that if somebody's going to this movie, an adult has been dragged along.
Yes.
And they throw something in just along the way to kind of keep it.
And there isn't.
No, there isn't really. And there's not much of a story to it because the bad guy's not that bad. And there's, you know, so that's why I think it was pitched a little bit too young in the way that it ended up being shot or whatever. But it is a great fun movie. The kids absolutely enjoyed it. And as I say, this is the last weekend now. And if the weather stays raining and that, there's going to be a lot of parents out there that are kind of like,
and they could do a lot worse than this.
Exactly. They're going to be done. And this is a could be a great way to spend the afternoon, take them off, depending on their age, one or the other, and they'll definitely come out of it after having a great time.
Let's go to something that is very much pitched at older, more mature adults, and that's Great Expectations on BBC One, Sundays at 9.
Yes, I love, I'm a big reader, as everybody knows, you know yourself.
Indeed.
And I love Great Expectations. It's one of those books that you kind of read 4 or 5 times across, well, I have anyways, across the course of my life. It's different things that come up. And I was really looking forward to this because the BBC do a drama, they knock it out of the park. This is a little bit dark for me. I kind of like things to be slightly nicer when I'm watching them. It's got Olivia Colman in it, Matt Berry. There's fantastic acting and stuff in it. And I've forgotten now, the guys that did it. Have they done Peaky Blinders or they did one of those?
I'm not sure.
I think it's the same people that did Peaky Blinders as doing this. And it has that kind of grittiness to it that you don't necessarily get in a TV Dickens, you know what I mean, type thing. But people are going to absolutely love it. The acting is that it's weekly, so it's on to about its third week now. It's on every Sunday. It's on at 9 o'clock. Anybody who I'm so jealous of that has the BBC iPlayer can go back and watch it again, or find ways, shall we say, in which to watch it again. It's shot very dark, even, you know, like everything is very grey. Everything, you know, there's just that sort of a grittiness to it that you don't normally get with this, which I suppose is modernising it up. It's getting some very good, strong reviews in different places. So it's definitely worth watching. Great Expectations is a fantastic story anyway. So it's kind of, you know, it's got a lot going on in it. It's probably one of the darker ones.
But I suppose too, because the story is so well known, because so many, and because the people who are going to watch it are likely to have read the book, they're going to have to find maybe a new angle. They're going to have to find maybe a new presentation, because it isn't as though they can say, tune in next week to see what happens
next.
You've read the book. You know what happens next.
Yeah,
so
you
they
do.
Have
you
to
know
find
the
something
end of
to differentiate.
Well, yeah, so many people have done it in, either in school or just, through, you know, come across it, given it as gifts at different points in their life.
Or seen the previous adaptations. It's been done brilliantly at different times down through the years in film and on TV.
It has, yeah. And maybe this will be the thing that'll keep the young, that'll get the young people interested in it. As in, younger people seem to want that kind of grittiness in there. You know, when you think even like an RT, you've got Kane and you've all these different types of shows. I watch them now and I'm like, oh God, they're way too kind of, I don't know, the darkness in them. I'm like, oh, I want, when I watch something, I want to feel nice.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to feel, I don't want to be dragged into the darkness kind of that's in it. And this just, I mean, as a story of that kind of time, this is probably one of the darker ones, particularly if you think of, like, you know, David Copperfield, Great Expectations. You know, you put all of those kind of together in a bundle, this is probably the darker one of it. Even if people haven't read it, there's like everybody knows about Mrs. Haversham.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's one of the, you know, there's certain things that are just kind of within
pop
the
culture. They're pop culture. They're iconic. People know them even if they don't know the source. Yeah.
See, I have to be honest. I am more likely to watch it now, listening to your description.
Oh, and then there you go. Well, then I hope it brings more people to it because the story is absolutely amazing. The acting is fantastic in it. It's like, it's you know, it starts, just even say the start of it, which is not the way the book starts.
Yeah.
It like, it starts with the one of the main characters about to jump off a bridge.
Oh.
Like, this is how it starts dark. And it just wore, you know what I mean? It continues with that kind of an edge.
I haven't seen it yet, but I have seen the social media discussion around it on Twitter and so forth. And there has been, I mean, it has been divisive. Some people are purists and they're like, oh, but a lot of people are responding exactly the way you're responding. They're like, this is exciting. It's taking a story that we know very well and it's putting it through a very dark filter.
Yeah. Because what's amazing about it is even the look of it is dark.
Yeah.
You know, the way it's like, this is just like, you don't see a lot of bright colour in it. You know what I mean? Like, even the way that it's shot, I don't understand, you know, the parlance more than I do. But yeah, you know how you watch something and it's kind of done in sepia tones, or you watch something and the colours are brighter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the obvious example are the Man of Steel movies, the Superman movies, which were devoid of bright colours.
Or look at the last Batman movie. I don't think it stopped raining the entire show. I'm not sure there was any. There was one bit vaguely shot in daylight. Well, it was sort of dusk. But I mean, the film's almost entirely at night and it was almost entirely dark. In the rain, and it was, you want dark, that's
shades
dark.
Of black, shades of dark blue, shades of dark grey.
This is what this is. You're looking at this in the...
Perfect for a bright summer evening.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen any really kind of sunshine in it at all. That's not the tone that they're going for.
Is it six? Is it eight parts? How many weeks are we going to be?
I think it's six parts, as far as I know, but I could be wrong on that one now, but I think it is six parts.
Yeah, okay.
Right, so we're about halfway through. We're going to take a short break. Back in a moment when we need to talk about Cosby.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
Let's go to the next issue, which is We Need to Talk About Cosby on BBC Two.
Yes. Disappointed you didn't reuse the word gurus there. Myself and Luna were expecting to hear that coming back in from the break, but there you go. Yeah, this Cosby documentary, 4 episodes, ran recently on BBC Two. And I think it's actually on the Sky, or it's on, I was looking up where, I forgot to write it in my notes, because I was thinking,
Sky Docs.
I think it's on some of the, so you can see it as well. It's available for streaming now, and it was made in America by Showtime. Bill Cosby, disgraced American performer, stand-up comedian, actor, producer, writer, and educator. This 4-hour documentary looks at his legacy by inviting a large number of people who either knew him personally, worked with him, or were evidently fans of his work and were affected by his work. And they talk at great length over the course of the 4 hours about what he and his work meant to them, what he and his work meant to America, and what the scandal, which has all come, everything's come crashing down particularly since 2014. What I didn't realise until I watched this is that there were actually rumblings about 10 years earlier as well. There was another lady who had stepped forward almost 10 years earlier. As documentaries go, I think this is one of the best I've seen because it's really uncomfortable viewing. The guy who made this, W. Camus Bell, comedian and television presenter in his own right, obviously felt and feels a great connection to Bill Cosby and the work that he's done. So that's very evident how hurt he is. And it's very evident how hurt the majority of these people are by everything that's happened. And what the camera does and what makes it uncomfortable to watch is it leaves these silences in where people are on the verge of breaking down.
Yeah.
Not just survivors. There's one lady in particular in episode 3 who absolutely cannot talk about what happened to her. And they just leave it there and they leave it in. And you find yourself, I found myself almost looking away from the screen. Like I was like, I feel like I'm in the room with this woman and I can't look at her. But there's a lot of moments like that when they show clips of his work where you feel, as a viewer, you feel the uncomfort that's in the room as these people try and find words. First episode looks at the 60s. I learned a lot about his career. I didn't know so much about his stand-up comedy. Yeah. I didn't know how rapid his rise was in the 1960s. I know his TV work from the 60s, I Spy, which is one of the shows that I enjoy and rewatch. In the 70s, they look at his career as an educator, and he moved into children's TV in a big way. And then the third episode looks at The Cosby Show, which I was never a big fan of, to be honest, in the 80s. I don't really like, even then I didn't yeah. like that family. But it was huge. I remember RT had it on a Sunday night at 7. It was massive. It. Everybody, yeah. And you realise watching this what a huge thing it was for black communities in America. But everybody watched it in America. I mean, it saved the NBC network. There's no lie there. I mean, it took NBC from last place to first place in the space of one season. In the space of a few weeks, actually.
And for that to be done by an African-American was unheard of.
Absolutely unheard of. And that comes across in the documentary and why he's so culturally important and why the work as he did as an educator. And he gave millions and millions of his dollars to schools and colleges and third level places. And then, of course, it all comes crashing down. And you really do. One of the reasons I thoroughly enjoyed this is that it you do feel that sense of hurt and loss from watching it, even when you didn't maybe know so much of that legacy. And what's interesting to watch, watching this and watching the Jimmy Savile one last year, the parallels with regard, I mean, myself and Luna, we were chatting about this last week. First of all, I mean, the weirdest thing about Savile and the weirdest thing, I mean, there's lots of weird things about Savile and the weird things, but how open they could be about what was going on behind closed doors. Cosby's stand-up material made reference to drugging women.
Yeah.
There's, in the third episode of this documentary, they show several clips from an episode of The Cosby Show, which is about a barbecue sauce, which he talks about how it affects everybody and how it, he talks about all the couples, his kids and their partners and how they all kind of get very amorous after having the barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
And it's a protracted gag that runs through the whole thing. There are references when he's on Larry King Live, you see him being interviewed in the 90s, joking about this thing called Spanish Fly, which he could get and drug women.
Yeah.
And you're like, the more than Savile who made jokes on chat shows about things that were actually happening, that's, they're like, what?
Hindsight is,
yeah. And they show these clips to people. They hand an iPad to these people being interviewed on the documentary. They watch the clips and then they react. And they react much as we react. They're like, what the heck is this? How did this get away with this? And the other thing that comes out in the documentary, particularly for The Cosby Show, is so many people involved in the production knew there were things going on that were hinky. Like, they taped the show every Thursday. There was a section of the audience that was sectioned off every single week. And 20 models, the most beautiful runway models in LA or New York or whatever, were always brought. And they all got to come and meet Bill Cosby after the show in his dressing room.
Yeah.
Everybody knew that was going on. But...
And he's married and everything.
He was married, he's married. And that comes up. So, yes, this is uncomfortable viewing.
But compulsive.
But compulsive viewing. And because he's such a pop culture icon, even if, like me, you didn't really watch The Cosby Show, you were aware of it, you knew people who watched it, it touched people. And that comes out in this, the hurt that the men and women who liked and loved and respected his work feel. And the other thing, of course, in the documentary is survivors speak out from the 60s, from the 70s, from the 80s and the 90s. Those women tell their stories. Some of them are recording new footage for this documentary, and some of them are shown in clips from interviews on like CNN or the BBC years gone by. And that too is difficult. And what's scary as well is that through the decades, each of these women coming forward, and they didn't come forward for decades because they didn't think to be believed, but when they did come forward, their stories are read. It's like they're reading from the same script. It's the same story.
Yeah.
You meet Bill Cosby, he's a nice guy, he offers you a drink, suddenly you're really sick and you pass out.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Crazy.
What I find amazing about it is obviously his crimes are fairly well documented, but as you say, we had no really understanding over here of what a significant cultural figure he was in America, and like the hurt across the communities of colour in America when they realised that this person, and particularly you saw an awful lot of like actors and different things.
Now, I'm going to have to cut across here. Fascinating this is, but I do have a caller on line one, and Finola, you might want to put the headphones on because you're going to be really interested in this as an avid theatre goer and play goer in particular. The Abbey is bringing the play Tartuffe to One Grain and Theatre from the 3rd to the 6th of May. That's Wednesday to Saturday, and we're joined by Frank McCusker, who's one of the actors involved. Frank, a very good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very well indeed. Now, Frank, you actually live in Glencolumbkill when you're not touring. You've been in The Fall, The Tudors, Penny Dreadful, a huge. This play, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, Tartuffe. Tell us something about the play.
So the play is by Molière, the French playwright Molière, and it was first performed in Paris in 1664. And it has been done pretty much every year since, in some translation and other, you know, countless languages around the world. So that's about 370 years of this play. So my line is that it gives Andrew Lloyd Webber a run for his money. It's a really terrific play. And the most essential thing to say about it is a comedy. It's a romp, but it's a deeply entertaining play. And our version is by Frank McGuinness, who, you know, is Donegal man, he's Bun Crana. So this his version of the text has a really particular Donegal flavour or northwestern flavour to it, which I think will play out very well when we go to Letterkenny.
And also the artistic director is Catriona McLaughlin, also in the Sean Moon.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm a sort of a newcomer, but I have a house in Glencolmkill. So yeah, there's a big Donegal connection. So the play is, I play Orgon, who is the sort of patriarch of a very wealthy family. And he's in middle age, and he's on a quest for some sort of deeper meaning, some spiritual meaning to his life. And he meets the eponymous Tartuffe, who is a religious zealot, really. And but yet Orgon falls hook, line, and sinker for all his teachings and brings him into the family. And the family are not at all happy about that because he's imposing this sort of religious zealotry on them. And what we find out, what the audience find out, and what the family knows but Orgon doesn't, is that he is a hypocrite and he's an imposter and it's don't do as I do as I say. And he's leching after Orgon's wife. So the family have to concoct to expose him, and that's where the drama and the comedy lies. And a lot of hijinks and a lot of surprises.
And given that this is a 17th century play, one of the fascinating things is that the themes that run through the play are themes that are every bit as relevant today as they would have been when Molière first presented this way back in Paris.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, even though it is and was at the time about religious hypocrisy, you can view this play. I mean, I know that there have been productions of it elsewhere in the world. And there was a production in France of it some years ago. And it was just after Trump was elected. So you get this sense from the play that you can get these charismatic figures who sort of see, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, you know, so they come in and they present something, you know, the sort of phony down-to-earthness or whatever that people buy, good people buy and go along with, and with disastrous consequences, you know. So it's very much sort of echoes all of that in a political sense as well as in a religious sense, you know.
It's also the sort of play, I would imagine, where you can stage it in varying ways. You can stage it in traditional costume, you can stage it as a 17th century play, or you can stage it in contemporary dress, you know, geared toward contemporary themes. What approach is being taken by the creative team in this one?
Well, the approach is really, there was one line in the Financial Times which reviewed it, and it said Versace meets Versailles, which is a nice way to describe it. So the costumes are giving a nod back to that period, sort of restoration, or, you know, late 1600s. So they're very lavish and very beautiful, but there are modern twists put in. And the stage set as well is this very, very luscious, beautiful room with a chandelier, and it's of the period. But then there's a very modern table, and then there's an antechamber which has fluorescent lighting, and there are mobile phones and whatever. So it's inviting the audience to see it in the beauty of the period, but to reflect on the play in a contemporary way.
Obviously, the Abbey carries a huge amount of tradition with it, and you know, the name Abbey just conjures up professionalism, it conjures up creativity, and it conjures up absolutely wonderful presentation, irrespective of what the Abbey is bringing. No doubt this play is going to maintain that tradition and continue that.
Absolutely. I mean, what's great about it is the Abbey do tour a lot, but what's wonderful about this is a really full-scale Abbey production. So there are 12 actors and this very lavish, opulent set. So it's an opportunity, and rightly so, for the rest of the country not to have to travel to Abbey Street in Dublin, but to see it in Letterkenny, to see it, we're in Limerick at the moment, to see it in Cork, Belfast, Galway. So it's a wonderful opportunity for people to get to see their national theatre in a really sort of full scale lavish production like this, you know.
And in terms of the logistics to actually get that stage, to get that set, and it's wonderful that we have theatres now like on Greenan that can actually take them in and do have the facilities within the theatre to allow those sets to come in. Logistically, it must be a huge, huge job to get all those sets, to get the 12 actors and to get all the backup staff as well from place to place.
Absolutely, and costly as well, you know. But, you know, it's our national theatre, it's funded, and it should be doing this because, you know, the taxpayers of Donegal are paying for it as well, you know, or Limerick or whatever. So yeah, but the logistics and the amount of money that it costs to do it are considerable, but you know, it's as it should be to get good quality theatre to all corners of the country. And there's a lot of hard work, you know. It's amazing, just outside the theatre here in Limerick, you see just this enormous articulated lorry with Arklan the Manistrock, you know, at the Abbey Theatre, and it's kind of exciting to see it, you know. It's our flagship theatre, you know.
Well, we have Michael and Fionnuala here, our entertainment panellists every weekend, and I can tell you they are both on their mobiles as we speak checking for tickets, so you are certainly selling it very well to them. Fionnuala, I just wanted to talk to you. I mean, you're an avid playgoer yourself. I mean, you must be looking forward to this one.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime the Abbey come out and do anything, it is worth dropping everything and making sure that you're on their list. We're dying to see it when it comes. Absolutely, it's been on the schedule for a long time. This is a play I have never seen before either, so it's very interesting to me when something new comes along, because some of the
what's exciting for Fionnuala about it as well.
You tend to have seen them with different groups along the way, and obviously it's always nice to see different adaptations, but it's lovely to go and see a play that you just have completely no preconceived ideas or thoughts on it at all. So I'm really looking forward to seeing it, 100%.
And then that's a very good point, because I mean, people will go, you know, sometimes you go to, I remember I went to an Abbey production of The Seafarer a couple of years ago, having seen other productions and, you know, knew what the story was, so was paying more attention to the staging and so on and so forth. But, and you know, you bring the standards like The Plough and the Stars a couple of years back as well, but it's going to be really good to actually see something. I'm completely new to this one as well, so it'll be lovely to see something brand new that we haven't seen before.
Brand new that's 370 years
old. Brand new to us.
Exactly. No, and I mean, to be honest, I had known of the play and I had known of Molière's work, but I had never seen it either or read it. So it was brand new to me too. But what Fionnuala was saying, that, you know, not knowing, even though it's this big classic, and what's even when we were in Dublin, just the gasps from the audience, because they're going at Orgon's decisions, like, because he's so quixotic and he's so impulsive and he makes these stupid decisions. And what's really exciting is to hear an audience literally gasp at some of the things because they don't know what's happening next. And that was so refreshing because, as you say, with other classics that people know, they're watching the play in a different way. This is just like great, you know, it's like telling the story afresh, and it's very exciting, you know.
Well, I can guarantee you have three seats sold anyway. Frank, it's been a pleasure speaking
brilliant.
To you.
Oh, good.
Thank
good.
You very, very much indeed, Frank. We wish you all the best with the production and roll on Wednesday the 3rd to Saturday the 6th of May.
And stay around and say hello after.
We absolutely will, Frank. Yeah. We absolutely will. Thanks very much indeed.
Lovely.
That's
lovely.
Frank great. McCusker there. As I say, you will know Frank from The Fall, The Tudors, Penny Dreadful, and from various stage productions as well. A resident these days of Glencullum Kill, maintaining the wonderful links between Donegal and our national theatre. Going to take a short break. Back after these.
Watch the show live now on YouTube, Facebook, and at highlandradio.com.
We've had a communication from one of our listeners. Dungeons and Dragons, they say, it was a fantastic watch, but I'm not pining for Chris's singing. Some of the John Wick films are on Film 4. I caught the show during the week during all the Biden coverage, though. They say Colin from Accounts. Mm. It's an Australian comedy between two people brought together over an injured dog. And that's, I saw the trailer for it during the week, and there my knowledge of Colin from accounts ends. Now, Michael, you were saying this was recommended to you as well.
Late last night, a buddy of mine sent a message to me and he said, he sent the link actually to the RTE player and he said, you have to watch this. And I quickly looked it up. This is bedtime. This is me going to bed, checking my messages before bedtime. And I was like, oh, this is, looks really hilarious. I think there's 8 episodes on the RTE player. I think I'm just going to watch them all between now and next week. It looks really funny. The lead guy in it is in a show that I mean, it's not a comedy. He's in the show Evil that I watch and love. He plays the husband of the main character. So it's a supporting role. So I was like, oh, this guy, I like him in Evil, but he doesn't get a lot to do in Evil. Now I see that he's been busy doing this other thing. It dropped in Australia, I think, just Christmas week for streaming. All the episodes popped up, I think, December 1st or December 15th or something like that. But RTE have been showing it and it looks really funny and I'm going to check it out and see what the crack is.
Another listener says, Paul O'Grady's Salvation Army documentary is very interesting stories. May he rest in peace. He had a heart of gold and did fantastic work for dog rescue. And that's been noted. I actually didn't realise until his death how much work he actually did with dogs and animals in particular. Documentary Steps of Freedom, the story of Irish dance, the caller says. Oh. Great stuff, apparently. And another documentary. Yeah, Roger Cox wins a case against the government. And that's a fantastic documentary, we're told. And caller then saying, what are the panel's thoughts on the 1883 to 1923 Yellowstone drama series? I've watched 1883, coming to the end of 1923, moving on to Yellowstone soon. A hard watch at times, but thoroughly enjoying it. You've discussed this one before,
haven't you? Well, that caller is kind of doing them in the right order, yet backwards. Because, obviously, the years are correct, but Yellowstone is what started.
Yeah.
And then 1823, and then they did the, you know, if you're going in the order of which they were produced, they've kind of got it a little bit wrong. I've only ever seen the first, the regular, Yellowstone, which was Yellowstone the one that started off. I've only ever seen that. It's fantastic. Michael's a massive fan of
huge
it as well.
Fan.
Yeah.
It's huge. Sort of like Dallas meets Succession type of a feel to it, like as in it's over the top and yet it's, you know, the characters are really strong in it.
The writing is amazing. I watch every episode and when I do my reviews, sometimes I quote lines of dialogue from episodes.
Yeah.
And at Yellowstone, I find week after week, when I pick out a line of dialogue and I go to IMDb, that turns out to be the name of the episode. It's like, I love that thing where it's so well written and it's sort of,
it's amazing. Now, friends of mine, Sheila and Denise, they'll be listening at some point, they have gone straight from Yellowstone to 1823, then to go to 19. Yep. So, and they are loving it. They're saying that it's absolutely amazing, fantastic. It should be very good, the early one, because
Sam Elliott's in the first one.
Yeah, it has Sam Elliott in it. It has Miley Cyrus's father's in it. There's a load of different people like that that are in the original one, very kind of country and cowboy. Then you get to the next one then and you have Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren. So I can only imagine that can't go wrong.
Yeah, but reviews have been fantastic. They're great shows, yeah.
Time is very much catching up with us. I want to reference just a few bits that we have here. Fionnuala, Unstable, Rob Lowe, John Owen Lowe, 8 episodes. A good watch on Netflix?
No.
No.
And it's disappointing to me because I really wanted to see it. I love Rob Lowe. I've loved him since the 80s. I forgive him all of his foibles that come out on the internet. So I've always just been a big fan and he's in one of those firemen 911 or 999, whatever they're called.
Yes.
He's in one of those, a Texas one and that kind of thing.
Lone Star,
One of those ones. But and this is written by himself and his son, John Owen Lowe, who also writes some of the ones for some of the stuff for 911. It could have been really good. It's based on this, like a family. They play father and son in it. You could really have seen it, but it's a little bit too light. And Rob Lowe tends to play this character that he seems to play in everything now, as in that he's very pretty and yet neurotic.
Right.
And he just seems to have developed a caricature of himself that seems to be the character no matter where he is. I saw so much similarities between this character and the one that he's playing in the Lone Star, whatever the
999
one is. Whichever one he's doing. That, and there's so many similarities in it that you're just kind of like, this guy used to have more range. The movie back in the 80s, Something Blue, where he played like a rower in Oxford or one of those, and oh my God. He walked through the mist and we were all fainting.
Yeah, well, to me, he'll always be Nick Andros in the original Stand. That's oh, Rob Lowe will always be to me.
Okay.
Michael, Star Trek Picard, is it working?
Season 3 is. Season 1, when you look at Star Trek Picard's audience reactions on Rotten Tomatoes, I think it tells the whole story. You find that the first season had 52% response from the audience. I thought it was middling. It was okay. Second season had 29% from the audience. I thought it was pure muck. I thought it was the least. It was the worst show I watched last year. I have a blog and I rate everything. The new show, the third season, has a 90% audience rating. I completely concur. It's very good. What they've done with the third series of Picard is what they should have done with the first season is they brought everybody back from Star Trek The Next Generation. That's who we want to see.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that they're all in their 70s. Jonathan Frakes jokes about this in one of his interviews. Like, LeVar Burton is the youngest and he's 66.
Yeah.
Everyone's in their 70s. They all look great. We love them. We love the characters. I'm halfway through the season. It's telling a really good story. It's bringing back not just the main characters from Star Trek The Next Generation, the main actors, but also Michelle Forbes, who was in several episodes as Ensign Ro. She popped up in the episode I was watching last night and they gave her a really good role to play, like playing a version of Ro 30 years after we've last seen her, explaining a lot of her past. So yes, very big thumbs up for the third season. I'm a little bit nervous because, as I say, season 2 was so bad and it's like a separate miniseries. You can skip season 2 and just go straight to season 3. But I'm nervous because I'm like, what if they don't stick the landing? What if it ends up being a bit rubbish at the end? But the journey has been really, really good. I'm quite happy to give it like an 8 out of 10, 8.5 out of 10. It's not the best Star Trek at the moment.
Did they make a mistake then thinking that Picard, the character, could carry a series on his own? If you're saying he needs the rest of the Next Generation characters with him, that he needs his Riker, he needs his data,
he does, yeah. He needs his Riker. I mean, I think part of the problem with season
one...
And
Riker's
one,
a very close character to you, isn't he?
I love Riker. It's my screen name.
I know,
Riker
indeed.
Donegal. Yeah, I've been using that for like ever since I moved to Donegal. And before that, I was Riker Leitrim. I love Riker. He's my favourite character. The thing about the first season was they introduced a lot of new characters and they brought in a new cast and none of them really popped for me, and I don't think they popped for anyone that watched season one. Season two kind of doubled down on that with some of those characters, but we just weren't invested. I mean, we didn't really care about Data's daughter. We didn't care about that captain guy who was kind of like Han Solo from Star Wars, that they were kind of... So those characters didn't pop and they've abandoned all of them. Except one, they kept Raffi, and for this year, we want to see Picard, but we want to see him fighting with Riker about what to do next. We want to see him with Dr. Beverly Crusher, and Gates McFadden is so good in this third season. They give her really good material, like they really give her material, and she gets some fantastic scenes with Patrick Stewart, and it's so good to see. And as a lifelong fan of Star Trek: The Next Generation, that's what I want to see. I want to see those characters back. And although Picard is definitely ending after this third season, Terry Matalas, the showrunner, the guy behind the show, he's on social media, on Twitter, I'm following him, and he has said he wants, now he's not the boss, he has to wait until someone picks it up, but he just wants to keep going with another show, Star Trek Legacy, which would have Picard in it, but would be the Next Generation crew. So hopefully that's what happens. Like Star Trek is in a good place right now with Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which I think is the best ever Star Trek of them all. Star Trek Prodigy is very close to being the very best. And if Picard turns into Star Trek Legacy, then we got three great Star Treks. Oh, Lower Decks is great as well.
Yeah.
And Discovery, which...
So basically what you're saying is by the time we get to 2037, TV will be wall-to-wall
Star Trek. And I have no
problem
with that.
And you will love it. Michael
Fanula,
we have come to the end. It's been a great program as usual.
It's
been a pleasure doing this. It's been a pleasure filling
thank
in for Greg
you.
Over the course of this week. Fanula, Michael, thank you. Thanks to Niamh. Thanks to Caroline. Caroline produced as well. Thanks to you for listening.